You're listening to St. PDEX Season 2. Today's episode is brought to you by CapEx Advisory Group. When organizations undertake large capital or real estate projects, they turn to CapEx for additional resources and expertise. To learn what an owner's rep can do for you, visit CapEx's website at ceag2.com. That's C-E-A-G, the number 2.com. And by the Open Partnership Education Network, located at the University of South Florida in St. Petersburg. The world is open for citizens, businesses, groups, for all of us to become a smarter, better connected city by learning together. To find out more about Open, including upcoming great Aresti speakers, please visit learnopen.org. Now enjoy the conversation. Joining me on SPX is Parrish Patel, who is the chairman of the board of directors and the CEO of HCI Group. Welcome.
Thank you.
HCI is known as an insurance company, but it's got some more things going for it than that. There are four and a half divisions. So I think it'd be great just to lay those out before we dig in so we know what we're working with.
Absolutely. So HCI originally was founded with one insurance company called Homeowners Choice. It's one of the larger insurance carriers in the state of Florida for homeowners and property. And after that, a few years later, we started what became Greenleaf, which is a real estate operation. We own various amounts of real estate around town, some of which you will probably know. Then we started Exzeo, which is our technology division, which writes all the software and all those kinds of things. And because it made such great products, we need somebody to see it. We started TypTap, which is actually built entirely on Exzeo products, which is another insurance company. And then finally, we also have Claddagh, which is a reinsurer based in Bermuda that reinsures some of the insurance companies.
That's a lot of interesting things to dig in there. Let's start with the jump from Homeowner's Choice into real estate. So what was sort of the internal workings that led you? I mean, it's pretty straightforward to start the insurance piece of it. Did you know when you started that just, you know, because of a vision that you had that a lot of these other pieces would eventually fall into place, or was that more of an opportunity-based move?
My life's been a series of opportunities, right? I wasn't growing up someday going, you know, someday I want to run an insurance company. It was never in my planning horizon. How actually the insurance company originally came about was the insurance crisis of 2005 and 6, when Allstate, State Farm, Travelers were all pulling out of the state. And everybody said, this is terrible. Well, you live in Florida, you sit there and you go, people will have to do insurance here and somebody will have to provide it.
Right.
So if nobody else is going to do it, why don't we start a company to do it? And that's what the genesis for Homeowner's Choice was. And back to this opportunistic thing, a few years later, the Great Recession's upon us and there's real estate selling for a fraction of what it was selling for a few years before.
Right.
And we needed expansion space, so we bought an office building. And when we bought it, it was 85% vacant. No bank would lend you a dime on it.
Right.
Then a few months later, we bought Tierra Verde Marina. It was at a bankruptcy auction. A year after that, we bought what's basically the Gator's Saloon, basically the south side of John's Pass. Mm-hmm. And same kind of thing. It was a distressed sell. So we sort of ended up buying things because we could see opportunity where everybody only saw risk.
Right.
And that's really been the story of the company.
And that's a great side benefit of having a healthy financial station where you have this cash that you can then, you know, when the economy's in rough shape, then cash is more powerful because, you know, the prices go down and you can really take advantage of it.
Absolutely. Right? You know, Buffett said, be greedy when everybody's fearful and be fearful when everybody's greedy.
Yep, I think that's
we've tried to live by that, yeah?
And since you mentioned Buffett, I know that he's been someone you've turned to and watched and how he's done business. What are some of the key takeaways in how Buffett conducts himself that you've tried to emulate?
A couple of things. One is in terms of the company itself. We don't worry about quarterly numbers. I mean, we do worry about them, but we don't let them drive our actions any more than necessarily have to because we're in this for the long haul. So when we bought the real estate, for example, it wasn't what people thought about what that value was today. It's what will be in the future, 10 years down the road. So we always try and take that long vision of everything. And it prevents us from doing, what's the phrase, short-termism.
Right. We were talking about the opportunity earlier. One thing that jumped out at me is that, you know, obviously you're coming into a place where other insurance companies in Florida they're leaving. And you said, I'm going to rush into there, which is sort of along the lines with Buffett's advice. Before that, you were an employee and doing process work and things like that, if I read correctly. So this was your first foray into being a founder and actually starting something. So can you sort of dig into how that rolled?
For my career before HCI Group, what had happened was I came to Tampa working at a high-tech company called Paradigm back in 85. I was there for about 5 years. And then a small number of us went off to be entrepreneurial and look to start companies. And along the way, we end up with this one company called TechForce.
Uh-huh.
And they, you know, if you bought a PC in the 90s and it broke under warranty, we would be the guys who would come out there and fix it. Apart from, I think we did every product, every manufacturer one time or the other, except for Apple and Dell at one time, right? Uh-huh. That's what we used to do. That company went public in 1994, I believe.
Wow.
And by then I'd left and I was busily consulting around the world, working on telecom companies and that kind of stuff. And then I ended up at 1998 at this startup called Global Crossing, which I eventually joined as employee number 40. To put this into perspective,
right,
what incredible days those were.
Yeah,
that was summer of 98. I left in some May of 2000. The company had gone from 40 to 15,000 people
wow.
in under 2 years. And it just was crazy.
And what was your role there?
I used to run their customer care and billing and basically the back office. Right?
Got it.
So I'd gone from being an engineer at Paradigm through all these different career changes to now I was the administrative expert in various processes and things of that nature, pushing paper.
When the first group of you left Paradigm, was it a situation where you were just really tight with the group and you knew you wanted to do something together and you were looking for a business, or the business presented itself and the group formed around that was most appropriate for the business?
No, actually, we didn't leave as a group. We just happened to individually leave.
Okay.
And then everybody's out there trying to do their own thing. And occasionally somebody would need help and they would call, hey, can you help me out with this, buddy? And you go help somebody out. And somewhere along the way, the whole TechForce thing evolved.
Huh.
But there were, you know, half a dozen people, but there was never a vision of this.
Yeah.
It just gelled into that as life went along.
That's amazing. And then all the way to a publicly traded company.
Yeah. So if you sort of think about it, HCI was my third bite of the cherry because it was TechForce as a startup that became public. Then Global Crossing was a little tiny operation, became public and huge at one point.
Right.
And then HCI is the third one.
And so, you know, moving from engineering to a tech company to back office administration to insurance to real estate, you know, it seems that you have a pretty robust business acumen. You went to school in Cambridge. How would you sort of describe your openness to opportunity or how you go about choosing where you're going to spend your professional time?
In terms of now where I choose my professional time, at one point about 5-6 years ago, I actually sort of sat down and looked at it. And I was chairman of two publicly traded companies. I was chairman of a local bank and a local chamber of commerce, right? And then you sit there and you go, and what do you do in your spare time?
Right.
So at some point, it just seemed like this was eating up all your time. And so I've, over the last few years, stepped back from most of those things, HCI being the one thing that still continues on. And it was partly also to open up to new ideas and new opportunities.
Right.
But it's one of those things of if you're going to do something different, you have to let go of some of the past, yeah?
And so when you went through that reflective process, you know, a lot of times people do that when they're coming into things, there's a, you know, excitement, a possibility of anything, or it just seems like, you know, a place with great gravitas that it's an asset to be connected to. And then, you know, once you process it and have it under your belt and you're there, then, you know, the actual nuts and bolts of the meaning of it, you know, it's always on a decline for the most part. And so, you know, how did your sort of meaning as it's attached to time professionally change when you went through that review period?
Actually, you end up almost in the reverse, right? So let's talk about the bank, First Home Bank. When I became chairman of the board, you know, banks have a star rating, right?
Mm-hmm.
5 stars means it's the most healthy bank. 0 stars means it's... people are worried about you,
right.
Extremely worried about you. So when I started at First Home Bank and became chairman of it, it was 0 stars. And there was a lot of work to be done. There were a lot of people to lead and work through all the bad loans, etc. But every year I was there, we got 1 more star. And then we finally got to 4 stars. And now it's a regular bank. And I enjoyed the challenge of getting it there. What isn't me was to say, now that I'm chairman of a 4-star bank or eventually a 5-star bank, that I will do this for the next 30 years.
Right.
It was time for somebody else to enjoy the fruits of that. And that's why I stepped aside. Most of these endeavors I talked about,
right,
when I joined, were in very challenging situations. By the time I left, they were hopefully in much healthier places. If you're doing team sports, you don't want to leave your team when they're in a deficit.
Right.
That's the difference that you get into. But unless you're going to be for the team forevermore,
right,
the only other time you can leave is when they're in the positive, yeah?
So digging into the challenge, you know, one thing I find when people, you know, move up through their careers that the challenge of going from a negative situation to a neutral or call it positive situation can be great and meaningful and fun. And it sort of gives you a path to walk down, right? You know, you can just get from here to there. And then after a time of doing that, the mindset shifts where what becomes more valuable is taking someone who is in a good situation and trying to build them to an extraordinary situation, which is a lot more amorphous, right? It's just a more open-ended where you almost have to define what extraordinary is. When, you know, when you have a rating that's zero and you get to five, that's a path that's laid out for you. But to go from five to, you know, theoretical seven or eight is an undefined path. And it feels like, you know, that's maybe where HCI has come into play for you, where you can mix these different products and bring in the new, you know, use technology to start expanding. You know,
absolutely. Look, that's exactly where life has been very fortunate, because it's in multiple dimensions, right? One, I'm getting older. And I will tell you, we have people who I sort of look at them and go, I wish I was that smart when I was their age. And we have people that are amazing, right? But they need to be developed. They need the experience. They need to be given the opportunity. And I end up trying to help mentor them along those lines. And because you can see the possibilities of how far they could go. If you roll back 30 years where I was starting out, because this is where we are now, you know, it's not where you start the journey, it's where you finish. And people have potential, tremendous potential. So yes, there's a lot of my time these days goes into mentoring, because you're trying to go for that superb outcome. The other thing is, you know, HCI is perfectly healthy and everything else. It gives you the luxury of stepping back, looking up and saying, what if? What could we do bigger? What could we do better? And that actually pays back. It keeps you young and trying to, there's always the next mountain to conquer. But the other side is it inspires and motivates all these other people that are also in your charge to aspire to a better tomorrow. And ultimately, that's, you could sum up mankind throughout history that way. Everybody's always striving for a better tomorrow, right?
Yeah.
Columbus didn't sail across the ocean to, because he thought it was going to be worse on the other side. He wanted a better tomorrow.
That's right.
Everybody migrate to America for a better tomorrow.
And part of that, you know, there's a saying that, you know, everybody says, if you don't innovate yourself, somebody will innovate you. And part of that mindset is let the tip tap, which is, you know, first moving into technology and then using technology to further your, you know, your reach into consumer facing things. So can you walk through the process of concepting, you know, that you needed this new thing and this new way to exist and how it ultimately led to building a flood insurance front end?
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess this, some of this originates from my tech background. In a really weird situation, the first company I went to work for was called Paradigm. Mm-hmm. And they were in the Tech 25 of 1983.
There were only 27 at that time, right?
Yeah. So it was, well, not only that. The funny thing is, there are only two survivors out of that 25 companies. Well, yeah. Right? And things like Apple and IBM, everybody else is gone. It's an interesting thing that you sort of talk about doing things for the long haul, etc. Almost all businesses go away within a lifetime. And so you sort of sit there and have that thing. And why do they go away? It's not because they decided to go away. Technology changed. You know, Atari was a great computer. Nobody buys that stuff anymore, right? It's a toy now. Those kinds of things sort of come and go. And you sit there and you look at any business you're in, you can kind of come to that conclusion. And so the question is, oh, do I just want it to be around for a little while? Or maybe we can have some fun. Maybe we can see what's possible. And if you have the luxury of being able to afford the resources for that, why wouldn't you try, right? You know, back to that what if.
For sure. And so when you thought about going this direction and making this new brand and investing this money, you know, beyond the standard business risks, what were sort of the culture or, you know, brand risks that you considered?
Well, actually, there are a set of risks that always show up. And this happens in all companies, right? When a company is in bad situation, nobody believes in the company. All the employees feel like, you know, we'll never succeed, right? Become chairman of a bank of zero stars, and you kind of have a lot of that. The other thing that happens is that when you do succeed and you're doing well, you have the reverse situation occur. Oh, we're doing so great. Why would we change? We know everything, right? Which also isn't true either, right? So how do you oscillate back and forth between that? And that's what some of these issues lead you into, is that you're comfortable doing what you're doing, but why don't you try to do something bigger, better, right? And in order to promote that culture, how do you actually implement it and actually make the transition happen? Luckily, I had being in the tech background, rumored stories about Apple. Mm. So when Apple made the Macintosh, right, because they were known for the Apple II at the time, they took a group of people and they marched him across the parking lot. That was the Macintosh theme, the left behind juggernaut that was Apple. You know, it worked out very well. And when we were starting TipTap, we kind of did the same thing so that we leave behind the homeowner's choice mindset, the stuff that we already knew that was working. Not that it was bad or was wrong with any of that, but if you're going to think of a whole new thing, you can't be bogged down by either your past mistakes or your current successes, both of which tend to make you want to do more of the same. And by the way, Apple repeated that several years later. When they were making the iPhone, they wouldn't hire anybody who had worked at like Motorola or Siemens or those kinds of places, because those engineers all came with ideas of how to make a phone. And actually, if you asked any of them, the first thing you would do when you design a phone is put a keyboard in it, put a number pad on it, right?
Right.
Innovation of an iPhone is that there is no number pad on it, yeah?
Yeah. So how did you go through that process of choosing who to march across the parking lot or who not to? And how did that impact the team?
Actually, you know, we, as you always start with these things, you had one person and then you added a second and then you added two more. And it just slowly grew from that. And again, it's one of those things that because I guess my value add in the mix was making sure I added the right people to the team, but we also kept a lot of the other people away from influencing them. Yeah.
So when you started with that one person, was the idea of a consumer-facing flood insurance quote system or homeowners insurance quote system there, or was it an intention at that point and the rest came later?
Well, here's the thing, right? And in terms of how far we've come along on TipTap, think of it like Uber. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody uses Uber, everybody gets it, right? But in order for Uber to exist, you need smartphones, mm-hmm. you need GPS, you need Google Maps, right? You need cellular data networks.
Right.
There's a whole slew of underlying technologies that have to build up. And then suddenly you have Uber and you go, I invented Uber. Well, you needed all the other stuff. We kind of had that challenge. So we step by step started building the block. So we've really been at it for about 8 years, you know, building databases, building Mongo program code and everything else, right? So as we've sort of come along, it's finally came together about 3 or 4 years ago. But then you have to decide, does it work?
Right. And those would have been useful for the parent company as well, and just by adding the customer-facing element to it, was that the big innovation internally?
Actually, the customer-facing item, think of again with Uber.
Right.
If you were working in 1990 to build Uber,
right,
when you finally actually let somebody order a cab, that's the customer-facing one. It's the tip of the iceberg.
Right.
It's the iceberg below it that's really the engineering challenge, right? And so that's, we worked on all of those things for several years, and then suddenly when we put the piece of the iceberg on top, wow, yeah, the world took notice.
We had a conversation about this previously, but it's a real success story. You know, it sort of goes under the radar, at least in Tampa Bay, because it was internally funded and it, you know, came out of a publicly traded parent corp. But in and of itself, as a standalone startup that was funded and grown, it's just one of the top performers in the area.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And by the way, we're also not known nationally either.
Right.
Because we didn't go about doing all the normal things a startup would do. And no disrespect to any startups.
Right.
Normally, when you do a startup, you have all these issues about you need additional funding and you have to do capital raising. So you end up devoting some time to marketing what you're doing. And someday it will change the world and all the things you have to do. We took a very different tack, was that let's make sure it works.
Right.
And unless it works, you also don't want to be embarrassed. Unless it works, we are not going to go tell the world how great this was going to be and then go, well, it didn't quite work. Right. So we had to wait till it worked before we said anything to anyone.
But there are a lot of great technologies that work that are better still underutilized. And, you know, given the things that a lot of back office stuff that you had done in, you know, say the last 15, 20 years, how have you found the challenge of, you know, playing in the same space as the, you know, the Geckos and that sort of thing to get consumers to the site? Has that been harder than you thought or about what you expected?
Actually, it's been about what we expected, right? In some ways, because we've gone our independent road. In fact, when we started TipTap, right, and Kevin Mitchell, who was president of TipTap, and, you know, we gave him quite a challenge when we started the company, because he took the challenge anyway, which was, we're starting a new insurance company. We're going to call it TipTap, which is, you know, it's not called Old Liberty or any of those kinds of nice, solid insurance company, and then something really different, TipTap. You have no agents. You're going to go build up your own agent network from start. Your main competitor is the NFIP, and they pay these agents 20% commissions. We're only going to pay 10% commissions. And, oh, by the way, we have to make a profit. And good luck.
He still took it.
He still took it and he succeeded, right?
Yes.
That's the whole point, that you didn't have a company where you had, oh, we're starting a company and, you know, State Farm is backing it and,
right.
you know, we pay the highest this, that, and the other. We put a lot of handicaps along the way
right.
to the company, because if the technology worked, it would still work. You know, if it didn't work, then all the marketing dollars behind it doesn't suddenly make it successful. Yeah.
Sure. And before we get too far on the road, jumping back, you mentioned the bank, and I've always been a little bit fascinated. You know, I know lots of people who invest in real estate and they're sort of normal things, you know, buy into a restaurant or whatever, but there are a select few people who open banks, you know, as sort of a business endeavor. So can you, you know, sort of coming in, because the first bank, Northstar, you were a founder of, and you came on to the other board later, but as you were contemplating this move, kind of walk me through the process of how you saw a bank and what your intentions were with it and just how you go that route.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So how the first bank, Northstar, came about was that I had retired in early 2000 and was around Tampa Bay socializing with people. And I had a friend, Marty Traber, and he was a lawyer well-known around town. And we used to sit around and talk about things. And then we used to go to this Chamber of Commerce. This was the Chamber of Commerce I eventually became chairman of, Indo-US Chamber of Commerce. Mm-hmm. And we were sitting there one day and we looked around. And we said, there's lots of young, successful people that we see around here. These are our friends. Why don't we start a bank and it'll be a bank for us? So the two of us sort of had this idea, and this was like 2004. And by the way, neither one of us knew anything about starting a bank, but we thought it would be a great idea and we thought it was a good business. So systematically, we went after it and we had time. And eventually, we raised $18 million, got a license, and we opened in August of 2007. So you learn all the items that you needed to do a bank. And of course, we were doing this in the context of no bank in Florida had failed since 1991. And typically, you would do a bank and you'd sell it in about 7 years, 7 to 10 years at about four times the amount of money you started with, right? So it seemed like a good investment. And lo and behold, we start. And the great financial crisis shows up. And then it got to be really interesting. But that's how we got into the banking business.
And so as you gained expertise in the business, what jumped out at you as the most interesting pieces of having a bank?
Banks are actually a very difficult business because they're very highly regulated. In good times, they look fantastic. It's running a bank in a bad time. You know, I learned more being the chairman of a zero-star bank than I ever did being a five-star bank, right? Because the problems are few. The other thing that's really important to know about being involved with a bank, especially on a bank board, et cetera, is that if you are on the board of a bank and that bank fails, you are presumed guilty and part of the problem. So-and-so is making these bad loans. I didn't know about them. Well, you were the board. It was your job to know, right? So most things in life you deal with, you're innocent until somebody finds you guilty. If you're sitting on a bank board, and even if you leave and it fails 2 years after you left,
right,
they will never let you be on a bank board ever again. So, you know, a squeaky clean reputation, claims, you know, fantastic credit history, all those kinds of things are prerequisites. And it only takes, you know, the slightest stain
right.
to cause an issue. And when we started, we weren't aware of any of these things. And you suddenly realize this to the standard you're being held to, which is actually, you know, again, learning and expanding.
Sure. You're born in Nairobi, Kenya, of Indian descent, educated in the UK, and then to America. Let's talk about just sort of the you know, that overarching journey and having that international experience, how that's shaped how you formed your companies from a diversity standpoint.
I guess I've grown up in a world where I've always been the minority, right? And even in times when I shouldn't have been the minority, somehow I managed to achieve that, right? But such is life.
Mm-hmm.
The other side of that is what that also means is that you, and by the way, a lot of kudos go to my parents about this, right? They've always encouraged that, you know, the middle ground, right? And what I mean by the middle ground, there are parents who would tell you, you know, just be in your own culture and that's all you do and you don't want to know anybody else, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then other folks who say, oh, this is bad. Let's try to become wherever the new place is and you leave the old country entirely behind. My parents took the middle approach that there are good things and bad things in both the old culture and the new one, and you have to embrace them. So, you know, growing up in England, they don't have separation of church and state.
Right.
So you sing hymns and Christmas carols and whatever
right.
in a church and whatever as a kid. I'm a Hindu.
Right.
Going home and saying, Mom, they might make me go do it.
Right.
There's no excuse. It's the word of God.
Yep.
go sing Christmas choir and learn a few things.
Yeah. What's interesting about that is for most people, culture acts as an anchor. It's sort of a way or a mooring that you have as you develop as a person that gives you a roadmap. And you've shown that some of that is to some extent arbitrary. It's where you happen to be brought up. And through your parents' urging, you sort of were able to cut that anchor to any specific culture and then apply it to a logic that overarches all cultures. So it's sort of a meta understanding of culture. But when you build a company, a lot of people in that company are, still attached to the anchor, and you have to sort of put the chess pieces on the chessboard to get the most innovation, the most ideation, the best working environment. And so how did you navigate that?
Well, I think leadership helps, right? So if the senior person in the room doesn't behave a certain way and communicates that behaving that way is not okay, it permeates throughout the organization. I give you a totally different one that's really kind of never talked about, but it's kind of big. At HCI, we generally have a no nepotism rule, right? Now, is an interesting thing. Being of Indian origin, I only have two sisters, and theoretically, by that definition, three nieces and a nephew.
Right.
But in practice, I have 28 cousins.
Right.
So I have seven aunts and uncles on one side and five aunts and uncles on my mom's side, right? And they all had kids and they all have grandkids. And so we're a large family.
They all want jobs.
They would like jobs. And, hey, wouldn't you like to be, right? All those kinds of things. But there are no relatives of mine working at the company. And it's not by accident. And the reason for that is because if you are going to create a meritocracy, nobody in the company should feel that, me and Joe over here are doing the same job, but because of his bloodline, he's going to get to be CEO.
Mm-hmm.
It's a given. You get the whole nepotism thing, right? So to avoid that, that's what we do. And because much easier to implement, if that applies to me,
sure,
it applies all the way down the chain. Yeah.
Right. And so meritocracy then would be a North Star essentially for the company. And, if meritocracy trumps family, how then does it play into other factors that might pressure you to not go on a straight, merit-based action?
There are always things, right? And back to that whole thing of there are always pressures to do things a certain way.
Right.
And there's always convenience, and do this and do that and whatever, right? It'd be very convenient to hire nieces and nephews.
Sure.
It would make my Christmases and Thanksgivings much better, right? But you have to sort of stay the course. And the merit stuff, we do from time to time get asked all kinds of questions, right? And this may be politically incorrect, but I was recently asked, about a year ago, I was asked, how many LGBTQ employees do we have?
Right.
And my answer was, I haven't a clue. The reason we don't have a clue is because what does that have to do with somebody showing up to work and answering the phone and doing their job, right? It's not part of our selection criteria. It's not how we select people or anything else. So I hope we have some LGBTQ people,
right?
But they're there because of their merits. They're not there because of filling a quota, nor are they not being there because we said we don't, right? And it's just one of those many areas that people want to tick boxes, and it's just not what we are.
Yeah, being merit-based and, not knowing, I think, is an interesting, this the standard thinking line is that, different people, because of these different attributes, have different experiences, and those experiences then lead to different types of thinking, and then that should lead to innovation. But the experiences aren't necessarily a good thing or a business-related thing. So it's to say that if we had, if you pick some attribute, say race or whatever, and you have, X number of these, and you say you want to balance that number or bring in diversity, then the people that you bring in, you're essentially saying by this specific attribute makes them a different thinker than the rest of them. And that almost is sort of a reverse version of the problem, right?
Actually, look, in terms of large scale endeavors, this actually gets kind of interesting, right? We celebrate individualism, right? And I get that. But when you have an army, you can't have individualism. When you sort of say, we're going up that hill, everybody goes up that hill.
Right.
You don't have, 1,000 people going, I'll do it tomorrow, or everybody making their own.
Mm-hmm.
You do need some conformity, right? Now, in terms of the diversity of thought, it's creating the environment and then let it just play itself out. Because you're running a business. Diversity of thought could be that, I like to work from midnight to 8 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's very good to know. but our office hours are from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m.
Right.
That diversity doesn't work.
Right.
Right. There is diversity that works and diversity doesn't work. But what you can do is create the platform and then lots of different people show up and add their own special sauce. Give you a perfect example. Last week was Gasparilla, mm-hmm. right? There's 120 floats. Now, in the old days, it used to be Ye Miss the Crew, and they had their own criteria, and that's all they would do.
Mm-hmm.
Having expanded it, there's 120 crews. Those crews don't look alike in any way, shape, or form. You know, they all celebrate different things, different parts of the region, but collectively, they make for a much better parade than if somebody had said, oh, no, they all have to look just like this, right?
Right.
It'd be like an army marching down the road, right?
Right. Yeah. And then I guess the question is, you know, in that specific instance, the variety, that's an attribute that is craved for that environment. And then it comes down to talking about what are the attributes. So, you know, when you talk about a group of people getting together and coming up with something collectively creative, you'd hope, I guess, in the utopian world, that's just a bunch of brains, you know, working together, and there aren't, you know, physical attributes, you know, that drive that. Because, you know, I equated to, you know, there were times when left-handers were not...
I'm left-handed.
Yeah, me too. That's why I know this. Yeah. Left-handers were, it was, you know, whatever negative thing. And so they would tie their hands behind their back and try to make them right-handed. But if you go into a meeting today, no one notices if someone's left-handed or right-handed, and it's sort of an invisible attribute. And, you know, we're seeing that, obviously, you know, I think that you're starting to see that in the gender equality, where a lot of the, you know, women are saying, I don't want to be known as the women XYZ of the year. I just want to be known as the XYZ of the year, right? And I think that's, again, moving in that same direction, where when non, you know, brain-powered attributes are invisible, that's actually the ideal place for diversity.
So look, I think you touch on a very important thing, right? We have this thing about diversity because of our sins of the past, right? Once upon a time, we used to have collectively the society believe, only if you look like this, will you be of the right mindset to contribute to our common mission, right? So that's why only people of us who look at certain attributes, whatever, were allowed into the club, right?
Right.
And the club had a mission, right? And the bad thing about that is when you do it that way, you're excluding a lot of talent, right? Speaking again politically, you look at the Middle East, right? You know, the women are second-class citizens and allowed to drive, et cetera. Look at it differently. Half their labor pool is effectively marginalized by making that one decision. Only men can think, right? Very simple. America has a great advantage over them because we say even women can think. Absolutely, right? But you get the thing that you've just marginalized half your population by making this one simple physical attribute conversation. And that's the sins of the past. We sometimes try to overcompensate for it because where we live now is the old organization had a mission. So does the current organization. There is a mission of what you're trying to do.
Yep.
You're just enhancing the labor pool or the people who can add to that mission. But just because our mission is to improve how insurance is done, may not be the same mission. In fact, hopefully it isn't the mission of everybody in the population.
You'd have a lot of competition.
Well, not a lot of competition, but you know, other people's mission is to make the best restaurant in town.
Right.
Other people want to be the best football player in town. Everybody has a different mission or a different team. You just make sure you're not narrowing your talent pool by attributes.
And I think we're probably somewhere in between the two in that there are sins of the past or, you know, if not even sins of the past, but infrastructures created by the past that need to be addressed and opened up. And, you know, your examples is a good one for that. It's just a, you know, a thing that's been around that, you know, is changing and will continue to change. But it's also important to understand, you know, what the end of the path looks like, and that it is, you know, once the infrastructure is open to everyone, then the ultimate goal at that point would be that the attributes just become irrelevant and everybody's just, you know, accepted on. And ideally, you know, maybe the perfect board in 100 years from now is, you know, a philosopher, an engineer, a poet, a cook or whatever, because it's just those, you know, that's true diversity of thinking. Yeah.
Yeah. I think, you know, true diversity happens when nobody notices different attributes.
Yeah.
Right. You brought up people being left-handed, right? Whoever takes a survey of how many of your board members are left-handed versus right-handed.
Right.
It doesn't matter,
right?
Because nobody used that to make the criteria. That's the equality we really should be striving for.
I agree. And so, you know, as we move through these topics philosophically, you're actually, there's some tangible action you're taking to further this. Can you talk about your board program?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, so, you know, in terms of people wanting to check boxes, sins of the past, et cetera, a few years ago, being a public company, and in fact, it's still going on, there's quite a push that you should have female members on your board, at least two. And if you do that, everybody's happy and so on. And by happenstance, we happen to have 9 board members, all male, right? Now, usually when that happens, you might be guilty of the sins of the past that you specifically don't want women. That was not how we came about this. How our board was composed was that when we were raising the money to start the company, we generally told everybody that if a certain pool of investors said collectively for us, this is much money we're putting in, and we would like so-and-so to be our representative on the board, we would make him a board member, right? We didn't specify who the, right?
Sure.
And 9 people or 5 people were nominated and they were all male. Hence, we ended up with an all-male board. But this became a problem because we were diverse in lots of other ways. There were people of color, there were people of, you know, different ethnic origins, there were all kinds of other attributes we were diverse in, but this one box we weren't checking. So at first you go, well, you know, you're just picking on us, it's not fair, we didn't do anything. But then said, all right, let's go try to find 2 women board members. And you immediately come to, actually, because I know them both, you immediately think of Alex Sink and Betty Castor. And I think there have been a lot of boards.
Hundreds.
Yeah, and it would be really good, and I know them, and hey, can you do me a favor? They'd be there. But, you know, that doesn't change anything. It keeps the people who are telling you you should be more diverse at bay because you've ticked the box. But if you really want to do diversity, it's marginal improvement.
Right.
Because at some point, you go back and you look at this, you say, half the world's population, 3 billion women, are women, right? And you can't find 2 of them to add to your board? Does that say something about them or does it say something about you, right? And then you sort of realize that one of the reasons you can't is because the places where you look at, it's so male-dominated. And it's, again, one of the sins of the past kind of thing. So if you were a country club member, we'd have you join the next club. But you're not a member, so we can't.
Right.
And that became an item. So we said, how do we not just tick the box for now, but try to do our little part in saying this should be a problem that disappears over time? And so this is why we started the Board Observer Program, was every year we will give 2 people the opportunity to participate in the board, part of board meetings, et cetera. So being a board member, like what I was telling earlier about being a bank board member and the issues and items that show up, these are things you know because you sat at the table. If nobody ever invites you to the table, how do you ever get the experience? So that's why we started this program. And we bring 2 observers on every year, but we make them act and behave like the full-fledged board members. And the reason for that is the best way of teaching somebody is making them walk the walk, right? And it's worked out spectacularly. The first 2 people we hired, the first 2 observers were 2 women. And then actually, as we had capacity, so if you're going to have to add 2 women, why wouldn't we add these 2 fine people that we have? And so that's what we did. And then right after that, we've got 2 new ones. This time it's a guy and a girl, or male and a female, I should say. And they're halfway through their terms. They rotate off this October. And one of the original board observers, Sue Watts, is in charge of selecting the 2 board observers for next board cycle. But we want to keep doing this because eventually having people who have the experience of being in boards and doing their things, right, lets you have a much better talent pool. And we have lots of conversations in tech and everything else about how Tampa could broaden its talent pool.
Mm.
A different way of doing it is that the people who are here step up.
That's great. I've enjoyed the conversation. I'd like to finish up. You've had such a nicely varied business career, a lot of success. So as you're sort of turning from looking back to looking forward professionally, what else still inspires you? Are there any more things you want to accomplish, or what meaning do you seek to dig into as you finish out your career?
Well, what my hopes and aspirations at this point are, and this goes back to the people, the young people, the company, and the young people at First Home Bank, et cetera, as well, is, you know, I hope someday to be 85 years old, because the alternative is terrible, right? So someday I hope to be 85 years old. And when I'm 85 years old and they're talking about whoever is the hot star in Tampa Bay or the movers and shakers of Tampa Bay at the time, I'd like to know that we gave them a start in their career, or somewhere in their career, they intersected with one of our companies. Because that thing of, I knew him when, right? There's no greater pleasure than that.
That's great. Thank you. You've made it to the end of another great episode. For more SPX, visit stpx.com. Thanks again to our sponsors, CapEx Advisory Group, Build with Confidence. CapEx provides owners representation for the most demanding construction projects. With deep knowledge of design, finance, construction, and public policy, CapEx brings your project to life. CapEx supports your organization with leadership and expertise to reduce cost and ease the burden on your team. Discover what an owner's rep can do for you. Discover CapEx Advisory Group. Visit CEAG2.com. That's CEAG2.com. And thanks also again to OPEN, the Open Partnership Education Network, which puts on great events around St. Petersburg, including Aresti Speakers. To see the upcoming calendar of events, visit learnopen.org.